Speaking of Liberty. The National Broadcasting Company presents another in this new series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. There was free talk in the old New England town hall. There was and is free talk around 10,000 cracker barrels and hot stoves. And there's free talk by free men every week at this time. Free talk led by your host, Rex Stout. You may know Rex Stout as the brain parent of that distinguished criminologist, Nero Wolfe. On this program, you will get to know him as an outspoken champion of the democratic way of life, Mr. Stout.
Thank you, Milton Cross, and good evening again to all sons and daughters of liberty. The general notion back of this radio cracker barrel is to find out, in a free and easy way, what the folks who write what you read think about democracy. It's why, it's wherefore, and where it's heading. Every week, I'll collar some journalist or critic or novelist or playwright for you and get him to talk. Generally, that isn't too hard. Now, this evening, for example, I offer you Clifton Fadiman, book critic of the New Yorker magazine and generalissimo-in-chief of Miscellaneous Misinformation, please. Now, Mr. Fadiman.
Now, Mr. Stout. I've got a card here with a couple of questions on it, and...
Not on your encyclopedia, Mr. Fadiman. I ask the questions on this program, and this time you'll do the answering.
Whether I like it or not?
Whether you like it or not.
And they call it Speaking of Liberty, do they? Okay, Nero, crack your whip.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, you're a book reviewer by profession.
By trade, Mr. Stout, by trade.
Okay, by trade. Now, Mr. Fadiman, you're also a Democrat with a small D, are you not?
I am.
Well, then, does your trade, which is that of a book reviewer, and your faith, which is that of a Democrat, do these things have anything to do with each other?
I don't get it. Ring up 25 bucks.
I'll explain. Take a communist book reviewer.
Why should I? It's a free country.
Then don't. I will. A communist or a fascist book reviewer obeys what I believe is called the party line. When he reviews a book, all he wants to know is whether the book will help or hinder communism or fascism. That right?
I guess so. I don't know what those boys would do, though, with the new edition of Mother Goose.
Well, that's easy. The communist would probably point out the fall of Humpty Dumpty means the downfall of capitalism, which all the king's horses and all the king's men, etc. And the fascist...
And the fascist, he'd tell you that old Mother Hubbard and her bare cupboard is a parable of the poor have-not nations who aren't satisfied with a bone...
And want nothing but the whole world, and then they'll be happy. Right. Well, that's party line book reviewing. Now, you're a Democrat. Do you review books in the light of your Democratic faith? Do you judge a book according as to whether it will help or hinder the things you and I believe in?
Yes and no and in between, too. You see, a Democrat believes in a free speech and a free press. Therefore, a Democratic book reviewer acknowledges the right of any author to hold any opinion he wishes, even an anti-democratic one.
But does that prevent you from attacking that opinion?
Well, it depends on what you consider the book reviewer's job to be. Now, some folks think his job is to tell you about the book and give some judgment as to its literary value, and that's all.
What do you do?
Well, I can answer that by giving you the story of my life.
You can have 2 minutes. That ought to do it.
All right. Now, 10 years ago, when the Depression was forcing all of us to think hard about the problem of the distribution of wealth, many book reviewers, and me too, were inclined to review all books in terms of that problem. So we praised novels that showed up the desperate situation of the unemployed, and we damned novels that dealt sympathetically with the rich. Now, today I realize I made a mistake.
How do you mean? You're not telling me you're on the side of the rich now, are you?
Less than ever, Mr. Stout. As a matter of fact, I think even a lot of the rich aren't on their own side any longer. No. What I mean is that I should have damned practically all of those novels because they were bad novels. But I didn't. Well, later on, the social problem seemed to obsess all of us a little less. And I began to review books from what they call a detached point of view. You know, the way a scientist will examine and classify his specimens. Well, that was even dumber.
You don't seem to even make out much of a case of yourself for yourself so far.
I'm not trying to. I'm just trying to answer your question about what my views on democracy have to do with my book reviewing. Well, now, today, I try to be neither detached nor dogmatic, and I probably succeed in being dull. Now, many books don't involve political principles, and I don't review them as if they did. But a funny thing seems to have been happening lately.
Happening to you? Is this still your autobiography?
It is. The Nazi onslaught has forced me and millions of others to realize that democracy is more than a political principle. In a very real sense, it's all of our life. In a democratic country, you love your wife and children differently than you're allowed to do in a fascist country. You worship your God in a different way. You study and read and play and make jokes in a different way.
What's all that got to do with books?
Nothing and everything. The love of freedom has now become so big a thing. that authors are affected by it as they never were before. It creeps into everything they write, and so it creeps into what the reviewer says about them. And that's why today, I can't help trying in my reviews to indicate what the author thinks of freedom. Because what he thinks of freedom is becoming much the same as what he thinks of life in general.
Well, most of the authors you review are on our side of the fence, aren't they?
That's hard to say. Most of them think they are and say they are. But when you examine the actual content of their work, you begin to wonder.
For example?
Well, for example, are novels that enthusiastically champion the old slave-ridden South and represent it as a kind of paradise, are novels like that apt to promote the sort of thing you're doing on this program?
I suppose not.
You mean, of course not, Mr. Stout. Particularly not if they defend, whether consciously or unconsciously, the old slave aristocracy, which was reactionary and backward-looking.
Now, wait a minute. Nobody defends slavery today.
No, nobody but the Nazis and those who want to get on their Bund wagon. But if you think a romantic historical novel has nothing to do with today, you've got another think coming. Especially if it happens to defend a caste system, a system based on the idea of a superior class. Because to our American notion, a caste system is the bunk. We know that some men are wiser than others, but we want them to prove it by their own efforts. When a state freezes itself so that people can't move up, but have to stay forever in the class assigned to them by a small master group, well, and when that happens, the citizen is dead, and the serf is born. And that's why the present war seems to me a civil war, too. A civil war between perfectly fallible and often unwise free men and theoretically infallible, utterly ruthless aggregations of tyrants and serfs.
I agree with you, Mr. Fadiman, but you're out of bounds, back on the beat.
Well, I've got two beats. The other is radio. Now, lately, I've been thinking how impossible it would be to run a modest little program like Information Please in a fascist country. Not to mention a really serious program like this one, Mr. Stout.
How do you mean?
Well, for instance, we've had on our little show eminent public servants like Secretary Ickes and Secretary Wicked, and personalities as distinguished as Mr. Wendell Willkie. We've quizzed them and kidded them, and they kidded right back, usually giving much better than I sent. Now, I submit that that informal man-to-man kind of relationship is possible only in a country like ours. Well, you say that isn't so important.
I didn't say a word. You're talking too fast.
Well, to me, it's important that I, an ordinary citizen, can treat Mr. Ickes, under these particular circumstances, of course, as an ordinary citizen, too. It's part and parcel of the democratic process.
And without it, you'd find it harder to make a living.
Well, that's not important, but it's true, I suppose. And, Mr. Stout, in a fascist country, you wouldn't be any better off.
True enough. Detective stories flourish only in a democracy. I suppose it's because in a detective story, the amateur sleuth always puts it over the official police department, and that would never do in Germany. It would be bad propaganda. As a matter of fact, it isn't only detective stories that are out of luck in a totalitarian country. The whole publishing business is on the blink. When the fascists grabbed power, they took over the newspapers and the big publishing houses as soon as they could. And ever since that time, all of those enterprises have been devoted exclusively to propagating the faith. In a totalitarian country, 100% of everything that is published is totalitarian. You tell us, Mr. Fadiman, how does it work in a democratic country?
Well, so far, we've made no attempt to coordinate our literature at all. Everybody writes pretty much what he pleases.
As far as public authority is concerned, is the publishing business, newspapers, magazines, books, and so forth, just as free to say something today as 20 years ago?
I'd say just as free, within the usual bounds of decorum, but it works both ways. The reviewer should be free, too, if he's competent, to act as a counterweight to the book he reviews, if he happens to dislike it.
For instance, Mr. Fadiman.
Well,
did you review Anne Lindbergh's Wave of the Future when it first came out?
No, I didn't. I admired her other books very much, but I didn't figure that this one was of any importance. I was wrong. It's very important. I think I'll review it right now.
On our radio time,
okay,
huh?
I'll make it short. I think Mrs. Lindbergh means well in her insistence that we work for a juster order at home and not try to buck what she calls the wave of the future. But the net effect of her book on the reader is to paralyze in us our faith and free will and initiative. I just don't believe in the inevitability of history. I don't believe that just because Hitler is changing things, such changes are necessarily in the groove of the future. All this talk about the new order is mystical bunk. A new order comes about when the citizens, you and I and our neighbors, take matters in our own hands and fight for a better future. But when a group of masterful men seeking power and nothing else take matters in their hands, you don't get a new order, but merely an old tyranny. A graveyard is about the most ordered thing there is. It's perfectly predictable. It'll do nothing but house more and more decay.
But anyway, if there has to be a new order, I would prefer to see it labeled Made in America.
The point I want to hammer in is that we can make it. That the future is pliable. It's no more inevitable than who's going to win the World Series.
Or the Kentucky Derby. If you've ever bet on it, you know how inevitable that is. As for a new order made in America, what do you think of the argument that we must make a paradise of our own country before we try to reform the rest of the world?
Well, that's the sort of problem that's raised by books like Native Son and The Grapes of Wrath, The Plight of the Disinherited Negro, or The Tenant Farmer and the Dust Bowl. Well, to my mind, that argument just doesn't hold water. We have to change those things, and we are changing them. And it's necessary that such books should appear from time to time to point out how remiss we are in changing them. But don't forget that in a totalitarian country, they could never be published at all. Negroes would die, farmers would starve, and nobody else would ever hear about it. Of course, our democracy has faults, but civilization hasn't. But to say that until we put our own house in order, we shouldn't take a position against totalitarianism is just plain nonsense. After all, if your neighbor's house is on fire, do you refuse to help him just because you have a leak in your roof?
I like to put it this way. The fight for democracy cannot be localized. It has to be carried along on all fronts simultaneously.
And by all sorts of men. Take Winston Churchill, for instance. His new book, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, is a collection of speeches by a former Tory who has learned under the bombs what true liberty means. And there's Ernest Hemingway, I think For Whom the Bell Tolls is one of the finest novels of our time. It gives us a picture of the true wave of the future, a wave set in motion by free men.
You know, of course, that certain reviewers called Hemingway's book propaganda.
You can bet your sweet life it's propaganda, and so is Anne Lindbergh propaganda. And speaking of propaganda, here's something that's been on my mind. Why let the propaganda for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness be left only to professional writers or radio speakers? Why aren't we all propagandists? Why aren't we all speaking up for democracy? We all have an investment in this democracy of ours. And the investment isn't a piece of paper with some numbers on it. The investment is what enables me to speak to my fellow citizens right now. The investment is what enables my fellow citizen to turn his dial off if he thinks I'm talking nonsense without having a police officer put him in jail for it, as would be the case in Germany. The investment... Well, it's in our privilege to laugh when we please, sing what we like, make jokes about each other or our government, bring up our kids the way we think best, and work together for a world in which those kids won't be parts of a machine, but free Americans and perhaps even free citizens of the world. That's an investment worth protecting and worth talking about. I say it's worth fighting for if necessary. Perhaps it's the only thing worth fighting for.
It's the only one I know of. It seems to me that there are two kinds of people in the world today, as always. Those who accommodate themselves to a world which is really being directed by others, and those who are accustomed to take that direction into their own hands. So far, this country has been built and carried forward by people of the second kind, by men and women of courage and free will and initiative who were, and are, not afraid to face the future with all it holds and make it their own, and I don't think we're going to change.
Period, Mr. Stout.
Thank you, Mr. Fadiman. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest this evening has been Clifton Fadiman. This is Rex Stout saying goodbye until next Thursday.
You have just heard the third in a new series of programs entitled Speaking of Liberty, brought to you each Thursday evening at this time by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the Council for Democracy, a national organization dedicated to the propagation of an American faith in democracy. Next week, Rex Stout will bring Dr. Lin Yu Tang to the microphone. A copy of the script of this broadcast, along with a list of books on democracy and the current crises, will be made free to anyone requesting it. Please address your letter or card to the Council for Democracy, 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. Speaking of Liberty has been presented as a public service by NBC and the independent radio stations associated with the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.